Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
We are all here to charge this administration with genocide! Israel and the United States are jointly complicit in the ongoing Nakba in Palestine. Together, they are rendering international law worthless and irrelevant!
In scenes reminiscent of the 1948 Nakba, tens of thousands of Palestinians continue to flee on foot from their homes in northern Gaza as Israel intensifies its aerial and ground assault. Three Palestinian groups have petitioned the International Criminal Court to investigate Israel for committing genocide and apartheid. We'll speak to Palestinian human rights attorney Noura Erekat, but first, we talk to the Israeli-born historian, Brown University professor Omer Bartov, one of the world's leading authorities on genocide.
Israeli political leaders and military leaders have made very startling and frightening statements about Gaza, speaking about flattening Gaza, speaking about moving the entire population of Gaza out of Gaza. That is a clear intention of ethnic cleansing. So those statements show intent. And that's a genocidal intent, which is often very difficult to prove.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israeli tanks have surrounded hospitals in the Gaza Strip following a series of strikes on Palestinian medical facilities. The World Health Organization reports Al-Shifa in Gaza City, the territory's largest hospital, remains under heavy bombardment. Thousands of Palestinians left homeless by previous attacks have been sheltering under tents in the hospital's courtyard. The Al-Nasser Children's Hospital in Gaza City reports it was attacked twice Thursday and nearly had to halt operations. And the Al-Ran TC Children's Hospital, home to Gaza's only pediatric cancer ward, caught fire after an Israeli strike. Video shows patients and medical workers evacuating Ran TC, carrying white flags, then running in a panic as the sound of gunfire rings out. At least six of Gaza's hospitals have come under fire in the past 24 hours. The Palestinian death toll is nearing 11,000, including 4,400 children. On Thursday, the White House said Israel had agreed to pause its assault on northern Gaza for 4 or up to 6 hours per day to allow civilians to flee south. The UN estimates on Thursday alone, 50,000 people were forced to travel on foot along what Israel's military is calling a humanitarian corridor. Many of them compared the mass expulsion to the 1948 Nakba that saw about 700,000 Palestinians pushed out of their homes and turned into refugees during the creation of the State of Israel.
What do things look like behind us? Destruction and death. It has become here a second Nakba for the Palestinians. What more does the world want?
The beach refugee camp is burning. The whole northern and western areas of Gaza are as well. They're driving people to schools and scaring them so they would leave. What we see today is a plan for a second Nakba.
Nakba means catastrophe in Arabic. Craig Machaiber, the UN's former top human rights official in New York, condemned Israel's so-called humanitarian corridors, writing, quote, four-hour pauses between massacres are not humanitarian. They are merely managed ethnic cleansing, saying to caged victims, go ahead, I'll give you a head start before I come to kill you again, is a cruel and cynical charade for which the perpetrators must be held to account, he said. You can see our full interview with Craig Machaiber at democracynow.org. The Pentagon says two U.S. fighter planes bombed an ammunition depot used by Iran-backed militia groups in eastern Syria Wednesday. The reported airstrike follows a series of drone and missile attacks on U.S. troops stationed in Iraq and Syria. This week, the Pentagon reported 46 injuries to U.S. military personnel over the last month. On Thursday, Yemen's Houthi rebels said they'd shot down a U.S. drone over the Red Sea and fired a barrage of long-range missiles toward Israel, they said. A Houthi spokesperson said more attacks would follow until Israel halts its aggression against Palestinians. In Paris, the United Nations top relief official, Martin Griffiths, warned Thursday Israel's assault on Gaza is poised to trigger a much wider war across the Middle East.
War indeed is a virus that always wants to expand. Then the current conflict is a wildfire that could consume the region, that could spread, and that we will think these have been the good days when we see what may happen tomorrow.
Here in the United States, a top State Department official said Wednesday the number of Palestinians killed by Israeli airstrikes is likely far higher than the more than 10,000 reported by the Gaza Health Ministry. Barbara Leaf, the Assistant Secretary of State for Near Eastern Affairs, was testifying to a House panel.
It is very difficult for any of us to assess what the rate of casualties are. We think they're very high, frankly, and it could be that they're even higher than are being cited. We'll know only after the guns fall silent.
Barbara Leaf's testimony comes after President Biden and senior White House officials cast doubt on the Gaza Health Ministry's count of the killed and wounded, even though human rights groups, the United Nations, and even the U.S. State Department regularly cite those figures. Here in New York, hundreds of people shut down multiple streets across Midtown Manhattan Thursday for another round of protests demanding a Gaza ceasefire and an end to the Israeli occupation of Palestine. Hundreds of public school students joined walkouts. Meanwhile, a large group of media workers led a march to the New York Times and later occupied the paper's building entrance for over an hour, denouncing what demonstrators called biased reporting toward Israel. Protesters read the names of the at least 36 journalists killed by Israeli fire in Gaza and distributed mock newspapers with the words, "The New York War Crimes," accusing the Times with, quote, "complicity in laundering genocide," unquote. This is Palestinian writer and poet Mohammed El-Kurd.
It is incredible to see hundreds of writers and journalists take part of this action, because it's telling us that journalistic malpractice, such as omitting facts and passive voice and denying war crimes and treating the lives of Palestinians as though they are less than, and demonizing and vilifying and dehumanizing Palestinians and Palestinian resistance, is completely unacceptable if we are going to be truthful and if we're going to be loyal to the rules of this profession we call our own.
World-renowned photographer Nan Golden has canceled a New York Times project over what she called its complicity with Israel and, quote, "how they question the veracity of anything Palestinians say," unquote. The outspoken artist has been active in recent protests for Palestinian rights, including this week's takeover of the Statue of Liberty by over 500 people led by Jewish Voice for Peace. Nan Golden also signed onto a letter of 2,000 artists, including Kara Walker and Tilda Swinton, demanding a ceasefire. Meanwhile, students on college campuses across the United States have been protesting Israel's U.S.-funded assault on Gaza amidst an intensifying crackdown from school authorities. At Brown University, 20 Jewish students who participated in a sit-in to demand Brown consider a divestment resolution were arrested on Wednesday. Hundreds of fellow students sang Jewish prayers outside Brown's University Hall in solidarity with the sit-in. Students with the MIT Coalition Against Apartheid held a peaceful protest despite threats from the MIT's administration.
"We are all here because MIT has now threatened to suspend all peaceful protesters who took part in the No Science for Genocide demonstration. And we must fight for this voice because we are Gaza's voice outside of Palestine."
There's a lot of energy around this No Science for Genocide claim, because a lot of people here, they come to MIT because they care about science, they care about engineering, they want to do good for the world. But the thing is that they come to MIT and become disillusioned because we find out that what work is going towards is not for good, it's not for people, it's going towards war. endless war.
Here in New York City, students at the Columbia School of Social Work held a sit-in protest despite multiple threats of academic sanctions. On Capitol Hill, students protested at a congressional hearing Wednesday, calling out the demonization of pro-Palestinian voices and what they called unjust charges of anti-Semitism to suppress any criticism of Israel. Students were thrown out of the hearing and arrested. The House hearing was called Free Speech on College Campuses. In the Democratic Republic of the Congo, a record nearly 7 million people have been displaced due to ongoing conflict and violence. That's according to the International Organization for Migration, which warns it's one of the largest internal displacement and humanitarian crises in the world. The Congo's eastern region has been the worst hit due to fighting between dozens of armed groups. Local communities have led protests against UN peacekeepers, saying they failed to prevent escalating violence. Just last month, at least 8 UN peacekeepers in eastern Congo were suspended over allegations of sexual assault. West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin said Thursday he'll not seek re-election in 2024. The conservative Democratic senator has earned millions of dollars from his family-owned coal business and is Congress's largest recipient of fossil fuel industry contributions. Even as he announced his decision Thursday, Manchin appeared to leave open the possibility of a run for the White House.
I believe in my heart of hearts that I've accomplished what I set out to do for West Virginia. I've made one of the toughest decisions of my life and decided that I will not be running for re-election to the United States Senate. But what I will be doing is traveling the country and speaking out to see if there is an interest in creating a movement to mobilize the middle.
Senator Manchin has received the support of the billionaire-backed organization No Labels, which is exploring whether to run a third-party candidate for president. Meanwhile, Dr. Jill Stein announced Thursday she'll seek the Green Party's 2024 presidential nomination. Stein ran for the presidency in 2016. Until recently, she was the presidential campaign manager for Cornel West, who was running for the Green Party nomination, but is now running independently for president. A federal court in Alaska has sided with the Biden administration in its approval of the Willow Project. ConocoPhillips' $8 billion oil and gas project in Alaska's Western Arctic Reserve is projected to emit more than 260 million metric tons of greenhouse gases over the next 30 years. Climate and indigenous groups who've been fighting the project say they're considering an appeal of the court's decision. The state of Texas has executed Brent Brewer, a 53-year-old who spent 3 decades on death row. His lawyers had argued the jury handed down a death sentence based on the testimony of a forensic psychiatrist who never examined Brewer and whose arguments were later declared to be junk science by a Texas appeals court. One of the jurors who agreed to the death sentence later recanted. And the Justice Department has launched an investigation into civil rights violations by police in the majority black Mississippi city of Lexington. This is Assistant Attorney General Kristen Clark.
We will assess whether the police department uses excessive force, violates people's civil and constitutional rights during stops, searches, and arrests, engages in discriminatory policing, or violates people's civil rights to engage in speech or conduct protected by the Constitution.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. If there is a hell on earth, it's the north of Gaza. Those were the words of a UN official earlier today as Israel intensifies its aerial and ground assault. Tens of thousands of Palestinians have fled on foot from northern Gaza after being forcibly displaced by Israel's attacks. More than half of all homes in Gaza have been destroyed or damaged over the last month. On Thursday, the Biden administration announced Israel's agreed to implement what the White House described as daily 4-hour pauses in areas of northern Gaza to give Palestinians a chance to head south. Many Palestinians fear they'll never be allowed to return home. Some have accused the Biden administration of facilitating the ethnic cleansing of Gaza. Images of Palestinians fleeing on foot have been widely compared to the Nakba, or catastrophe, when some 700,000 Palestinians were violently expelled from their homes upon Israel's founding in 1948. We begin today's show with the Israeli-born historian Omer Batov, who recently signed an open letter warning of Israel committing a potential genocide in Gaza. Umar Bartov is a professor of Holocaust and Genocide Studies at Brown. The United States Holocaust Memorial Museum has cited him as one of the world's leading specialists on the subject of genocide. Bartov is the author of numerous books, including most recently Genocide, the Holocaust, and Israel-Palestine, First-Person History in Times of Crisis. Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez and I spoke to Professor Umar Bartov on Wednesday from his home in Cambridge, Massachusetts. I began by asking him to talk about his own experience serving as an Israeli soldier in the Northern Sinai in the 1970s and how it's impacted his view on what's going on today.
I was a soldier in the IDF and the Israeli Defense Forces between 1973 and 1976. And so as a young soldier, the first thing that I experienced was the trauma, the huge surprise of the Egyptian and Syrian attack on Israel on October 6th, 1973. And I should say that when the Hamas attack on Israel occurred on the 7th of October, 2023, 50 years and a day later, that was quite traumatic, I think, for myself and many members of my generation. And we can talk further about why it was so traumatic. But in the course of my service, I also served in the Northern Sinai, and the command post that I belonged to was in Gaza. And so I would go quite often to Gaza, which was then had a population of about 350,000, was poor, hopeless, and congested. And since then, of course, now we have between 2 and 2.5 million people living in Gaza, which is much poorer, much more congested, and whose population is much more desperate and has been desperate for a long time, considering that it's been under Israeli siege now for 16 years. So for me, the lack of progress for all those years in somehow resolving this terrible humanitarian problem is very personal. And I should add one thing. I was usually not employed as a soldier in occupation duties, but there was a time that I was. And I have a very distinct recollection of that, leading my platoon through an Egyptian city at the time with people looking at us from behind the windows, obviously not wanting us to be there, obviously afraid of us, and us walking on the street, obviously feeling uncomfortable being where we are and being somewhat afraid of what might happen to us as we were marching there. And that sort of sense of what being an occupation soldier means stayed with me all those years, and it's always made me, has been one of the reasons, a sort of more personal rather than political, analytical reason why I've always thought that it's time to end this occupation, for which we called in that August 4th petition 2 months before the Hamas attack on Israel.
And Professor, I'm wondering, we hear often now these days, especially in conflicts such as these, the terms crime against humanity, war crime, genocide. Most people don't understand the distinction. And for some of us, war itself is a crime. And saying a war crime is almost redundant. But I'm wondering if you could give us more of a guidance or sense of the distinction between these terms.
Yes, so I think that's a really important question, because people, as you say, just use these terms without really thinking what they mean. And because genocide is perceived as the worst crime than any atrocity that happens, anything that people think is deserves some sort of extreme title, they call genocide. So there are actually UN resolutions on war crimes and on genocide, and they define them clearly. Now, one can dispute those definitions, but those are the definitions under international law. The convention, the UN Convention on Genocide from 1948 defines it as the intent to destroy in whole or in part a national, ethnical, racial, or religious group as such. And that's a very important definition because it calls for two things. It calls, first of all, for intention. You have to show that the killing is intentional. It's not just part of a war, part of violence, but it's intentional. And second, that the intention is to destroy that group, defined as such by the perpetrator as such. That is, it's not the killing of individuals, it's the killing of individuals as members of a particular group. That's very different from war crimes, because war crimes are violations of the laws and customs of war against both combatants and non-combatants, civilians. And crimes against humanity has to do with extermination or other mass crimes against any civilian population. You do not have to show intent, and it does not have to happen at a time of war. So it is important to distinguish between these three categories, and I would add to it a third, which has a definition, although there is no resolution on it, which is ethnic cleansing. Ethnic cleansing is the attempt to remove a population from a particular territory, usually because you want that territory and you don't want the people living on it to stay on it. Genocide is the attempt to kill a particular group wherever it is. But there is a connection between the two, because often ethnic cleansing becomes genocide. That happened, in fact, in the Armenian genocide in World War I, and it happened, in fact, also in the Holocaust, which began as an attempt to remove Jews from particular territories. And then when the Germans felt there was no place to move them to, they decided to murder them en masse. So if we think about these different categories, we can distinguish between what we see on the ground and how we feel about it.
And your sense of what is happening in terms of these categories right now in Gaza?
So my sense is the following. Israeli political leaders and military leaders have made very startling and frightening statements about Gaza, speaking about flattening Gaza, speaking about Hamas, but by sort of extending it also by extension also Gazas in general as human animals, speaking about moving the entire population of Gaza out of Gaza. That is a clear intention of ethnic cleansing. So those statements show intent, and that's a genocidal intent, which is often very difficult to prove in genocide. People who carry out genocide don't always want to say that they're doing it. The second is, what are they actually doing there? And military leaders on the ground keep saying that what they're trying to do is to hit Hamas targets, that Hamas often, and I think that's often true, places its own headquarters, rockets and so forth, under hospitals, inside mosques, playgrounds, schools and so forth. So the military claim that they're trying to hit Hamas, not the population, but unfortunately the population is also getting killed. In that sense, there is clearly disproportionate killing of civilians. That is, the numbers, as you quoted earlier, are now estimated to be over 10,000. And even if we don't believe the numbers given out by Hamas, they're still in the many thousands. They may even be more, because many bodies are probably buried under the debris. And of those, at least 4,000 are children. And one has to remember that half of the population of Gaza is under 18 years old. So to me, there is an indication that there are war crimes happening in Gaza, potentially also crimes against humanity. Whether at the moment this is genocide, my own sense is that it is not genocide at the moment, because there is still no clear indication of an attempt to destroy the entire population, which would be genocide, but that we are very close on the verge of that. And if this so-called operation continues, that may become ethnic cleansing. In part, it's already happened with the move of so many Palestinians from northern Gaza to southern Gaza, and that may become genocide.
Professor Omer Bartov, I was really struck by you saying it was in August that you joined other leading historians and Israeli scholars in signing this letter criticizing the, quote, regime of apartheid. So that is 2 months before Hamas attack of October 7th. Now, often these days, after the attack that killed over 1,300 people in Israel, if you raise any kind of context, you're accused of justifying what happened. If you, as a historian, can talk about your use of that term. I remember years ago interviewing the Nobel laureate, Archbishop Tutu, in South Africa. And he said when he went to the occupied territories, he found it worse than apartheid in his own country of South Africa, which he survived. So your clearly thought out use of this term, and then a discussion about what it means to try to explain what's happening, including using the term occupation.
So let me say, when we crafted that statement, and we worked on it quite a bit in July and finally issued it, so-called the elephant in the room. The elephant in the room that we were talking about was the occupation, and which we defined as in the West Bank as a regime of apartheid. Now, the reason we did it at the time was that, as you remember, there were vast protests in Israel at the time against the Netanyahu's government, the Netanyahu government's attempt to so-called overhaul the judicial system, which was really an attempt to undermine the rule of law in Israel, to strengthen the executive and weaken the judiciary, which is the only control over the executive in Israel, with the goal of extending the occupation regime in the West Bank, and finally of annexing that area and making life impossible for the Palestinian population there. There are over 500,000 Jewish settlers there, and somewhere around 3 million Palestinians living there. Now, what do we mean by apartheid? First of all, people tend to think of apartheid as what happened in South Africa, and the term comes from there. But there is, in fact, a UN resolution on apartheid that defines what apartheid is. And curiously, all the elements of that are mentioned in that resolution exist also in the West Bank, the most important of which is that you have two populations in the West Bank, Jews and Palestinians. The Jews, the settlers, are extraterritorial Israeli citizens. They live under Israeli law, or some kind of figment that creates them as living under Israeli law. They can vote to the Israeli parliament. They enjoy all the rights of democracy the Jews in Israel enjoy. The Palestinians there live under a completely different set of laws, which give them almost no rights at all. That is, they live under a military regime. They're tried before military courts, where the judges are lawyers on reserve service, Israeli lawyers on reserve service. One can detain them endlessly in prison. And so these are two groups that live under totally different laws. They're also separated from each other by a set of roads, roadblocks, checkposts that make life increasingly difficult for Palestinians and make life much better for the Jewish population there. So from that point of view, there's clearly an apartheid regime in the West Bank, and that has in many ways filtered into Israel. That is, generation after generation of young Israeli men and women are called up and go to serve as policemen in the West Bank, in military uniform. Most of what they do is police the population. And that has a corrupting impact on more and more generations of Israelis who get used to the idea that they can break into homes at 4 a.m, arrest whoever they like. And so that effect is not only that we have an apartheid regime, but we have a corruption of democracy in Israel itself, which ultimately resulted in this attempt by Netanyahu's regime to change the very system of democracy.